Well, first of all, I'm going to ask you this morning, if you don't mind, just to keep my train of thought on the tracks, if you hold questions and comments till the end, I'm sure we'll have some time for that. So if you'd be so kind as to hold those. And today we begin the Song of Songs. I know we normally call it the Song of Solomon, but in the Bible it's called Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. And you can see the word for shir right there. That's the first word. And there's the word shir again. And the second word, Shir HaShirim, the Song of the Songs. What that means is that this is the song that all other songs would like to be. This is the poem that all other poems are just a mere shadow of. This, when you say the something of the something, it's like saying the King of Kings. In other words, the King of Kings, Messiah, he is the epitome, he is the archetype of every king that has ever been or ever will be. And he's the one that all the other kings can only try to be like, but he's the King of the Kings. We talk about the age of the ages in Scripture. In other words, we have different ages through the scriptures and through human history, but there's an age coming which all these ages would like to be. And no matter how much people try to establish peace on earth and an equitable government and health and prosperity, there's an age of the ages coming. They'll put all the rest to shame. And at the tabernacle, the temple, you've got the outer court, you've got the holy place, but then you have the holy of holies, the holiest of all. There's no place, no thing more holy than that cube there, the holy of holies. You get the idea? So here we have the song of all songs. All other songs are just splinters, shadows, cheap imitations of this one. And what is this song about? Sex. Commentators try to soften it, say it's about marriage. No. It's implied, but it's what marriage is about. Now, we have to understand how wise Solomon was. So let's get the big picture. And you can understand how wife said, I don't want any questions, all right? So the big picture is Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, short of Messiah himself, who's the King of Kings. He wrote three books. He wrote Proverbs, which is the book about the soul. It teaches us how to be wise, our minds, how to strengthen our emotions and make good decisions. It talks about strengthen our wills and how to control our emotions. It's all about the soul. Proverbs, of the three books Solomon wrote, this it's the most popular because it speaks to what I am and what you are. You're a soul, I'm a soul. But we have bodies. And so he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes to talk about just the physical realm. And he always talks about under the sun and how temporary it all is. It's kind of a depressing book, at least to me it is. And then he wrote a book just about spiritual things. That's this one, the Song of Songs, which the rabbis have said for centuries is the most spiritual book in the entire Bible. And I totally agree with that. Absolutely and completely. But with this book, he's written it on three levels. The deepest level is the spiritual level. Everything we read about here is about the bride and the bridegroom, about God and his people. That's what the book is all about. But what did God create to teach us about that most spiritual and intimate relationship of relationships? What did God create in the physical world that could begin to come close to the joy, to the pleasure, to the life-generating power of being one with God? And you know what he created? Sex between a husband and a wife, between a man and a woman. Because nothing else could come close to beginning to capture the power and the beauty and the essence and the life-giving and the joy, the unity that God wants with us. But Solomon realized it's not very polite to talk explicitly about sex. It's very distracting. So what he does, he talks about sex by using fragrances, flora, flowers, animals, colors. He talks about the lush physical creation. But if you know how to read the book, you realize everything out here symbolizes what takes place in the bedroom. But that is a picture of something much deeper. Now, we have to be very careful with this. This is why I left this book to last, and why, although I've loved studying the book and I've loved discussing it with Robin, I've dreaded sitting up here and teaching it. Because how do you do this? And how do you talk about a book that's this intimate without being explicit or without us allowing our thoughts to be distracted and moving from truth into something wicked and lustful and something evil? But the thing is, God put this book in the Bible anyway because he's trusting you to be up to the task. He's trusting you as his students to be able to handle it. And so if God does, I do too. But I think instead of using the word sex throughout the teaching, I'll use the word intimacy. Okay? So if there are children listening, it sounds like a big boring word. All right? Now, because this is such a spiritual book, it's almost like it reminds me of reading Alice in Wonderland, which is one of my all-time favorite books. I remember, I think I was maybe 7 years old when I read that book. In fact, I remember specifically reading it on the way to church instead of my Sunday school lesson. Reading it on the way to church, in the back of the car, Thomastown Baptist Church. I remember putting that book, my bookmark in there, and putting it down on the floor, and then rushing back out to the car before the rest of the family did so I could pick up where I left off. I was so captivated by that book. And in that book, you can never quite, one thing kind of merges into another. You can never see around the corner. Things are not distinct in that book. Neither are they here. In Song of Solomon, it's hard to tell often who's talking. You've got three characters in the book. You've got the bride, we'll call her the bride. You've got the bridegroom, who's the king. So you have the woman and you have the man. But then you've got a chorus of women singing. And it's often difficult to tell when one leaves off and the other one picks up. They kind of flow into one another. And the chorus of women often speak as if they are the bride, which is a hint because the bride of Messiah is collective, isn't it? Also, it's hard to tell when things are taking place. Time kind of flows forward and backwards and loops back on itself. It's hard to tell where things are taking place. At one moment, you're in the bedroom. The next moment, you're out under the trees with the same thing happening. It's also difficult to tell when the person is conscious and when they're dreaming. It goes in from consciousness into a dream state and back into consciousness. Because in the spiritual realm, things flow together. The physical realm, things are very distinct. I'm here, you're there, you're there, you're there, and you're there, and I can see all the separate bodies, and that's how I know how many souls are here. And the pew is here, and the wall is there, and the ceiling's up there, and everything's distinct and separated. The spiritual realm, not so. In the spiritual realm, this is why fragrances are used to express spiritual things, because fragrances can mix together and become totally one. You can experience them all together at the same time. You see that happening here. Whenever you encounter honey or some kind of fragrance in this book or fruit, it's talking about intimacy. Now, spiritual things can only be discussed by means of symbols and allegory. If I ask you to talk about something spiritual, describe it to me, here's what you'll do. You'll say, well, it's like. You can't do it without using the word like. In other words, to describe something spiritual, you have to find something physical that it's like. And then if you can understand that physical thing, you can get a glimpse of the side of your head what the spiritual is. You cannot talk about spiritual things directly. You just can't do it. They're spiritual. We're very physically oriented. That's just how it is. There were two masters of allegory in the Bible. Solomon, the son of David, and Yeshua, the son of David. They were the masters. No one in the scriptures come close to them. Now, David was a poet. He wrote the book of Psalms, or most of the Psalms and Psalms. And he was a master of allegory as well. But his son Solomon, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson Yeshua, he didn't hold a light to either of them. When we were going through Ecclesiastes, you read many allegories there without realizing it. I pointed out a couple of them to you. Last week we looked at the one about old age. He talks about how the windows grow dim and the myrtle blossoms come out, your hair turns white, and the grindstones start to break down, the teeth. But he's using all these analogies, an allegory to teach something else. He talks about a city, a small town that is laid siege to by a powerful king. But there's a poor wise man who comes. Because of his wisdom, the town wins the battle. It's a picture of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, and the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination. Let's look at one. We touched on this in Proverbs, but I want you to look at it again. A Hebrew word here. The word ani. Ani. Now, Hebrew students, what does the word ani mean? I. Not I like eyes I see with, but like I, me, myself. It means I. But there's another blank. What else does the word ani mean? What? Four?
Poor?
Yeah, it does, but there's an object, there's a thing, not an adjective. It's a boat. Boat. Sometimes they add a hey on the end, aniyah, for boat, but most of the time it's just ani. So when you read about a boat in Scripture, wherever you see a boat in Scripture, it's a picture of you. Jonah was in the boat. They didn't belong in the boat. And until they threw him out of the boat, there was a storm. Yeshua was in a boat. And there's a storm. They wake him up. And once they awaken Yeshua, the storm is calmed. How about the story where Yeshua, he wants to address the crowd. So what does he do? He gets into a boat and moves off a little way into the water. You are that boat. And if Yeshua is in you, the only way he can address the crowds is to put a little distance between you and them. Come apart and be separate. And it's not isolated, but you have to be a little distant from the crowd. Not totally isolated, but separate enough that your life is unique and different enough that from your boat of you, he can address the others. Now look at Proverbs for a second. We touched on this. In Proverbs 23, it talks about the alcoholic, the drunk. Remember that? And then listen to what it says. Verses 33, 34. Proverbs 23, verses 33, 34. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. And you'll be like one, now get this, you'll be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like one who lies down on top of a mast. Now there's a boat here, it's not mentioned, but you're lying down in the middle of the sea. How'd you get there? You got out of the boat. Or you're sleeping on top of the mast, which is kind of impossible. In other words, you're everywhere you shouldn't be. And the one place you should be is yourself. You should be in the boat. The boat is me. The boat is you. The boat is yourself. And the drunk is not himself. You get it? He's somewhere around. He's in the vicinity. But he's not in the boat where he belongs. And any person who suffers from addiction, whether it's chemical, whether it's pornographic, whether it's addiction to leisure or to exaggeration or whatever it is, you are not yourself. You're a phantom soul. You're not in the boat. Get back in the boat. God created you to be you, not something you'd rather be, and not something that you want to escape into. You have to be yourself. And somehow, as I follow Yeshua, I become more my unique self and more like him at the same time. I don't understand how that works at all. I'll never have that figured out. Oh, but how about this one? Proverbs 30. Proverbs 30, verses 18 to 20. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. First, the way of an eagle in the sky. Second, the way of a serpent on a rock. Third, the way of an ani, in the middle of the sea. And the way of a man with a maid. Now, when you think about an eagle in the sky, that's not too complicated. And though it seems kind of weird watching a snake go across a rock, you can figure that out too. And a boat in the sea? Certainly Solomon understood navigation. What's he really talking about? Well, when you read about an eagle in the sky, the first place you find the word eagle, Nesher, is in the book of Exodus, where God takes his people out of Egypt and he says, I mounted you up on my wings like eagles, and like on my back, like an eagle takes its young, and I took you like an eagle takes its children out of Egypt. And thus, in other words, he's saying, I don't understand the rescuing power of God. It's be too wonderful for me. And a snake on a rock, who's the serpent in Scripture? Always the enemy. And I don't understand the enemy's ways on the rock. I can't figure out where he's going, what he's going to do. I don't understand the eagle. I don't understand the serpent. And then, who's between God and the enemy? The boat and the sea. That's me. That's you. Navigating the waters of this world. Says, that's too wonderful for me. Yet somehow God brings us to the goal. He brings us to the safe harbor. And then he sums it all up. The way of a man with a maid. And that's what the book of Song of Solomon is all about. Oh, and another boat. It just occurred to me during the second prayer service. We went through the Ishit Kyle. What does it say about her? She is like a merchant ship. There's the word Ani again. And she gets her food from afar. Why does this woman get her food from a faraway place? You have to interpret the allegory again. Women back then didn't say, oh, I'm hungry, let's send a ship out for some food. They grew their own food. Because it even talks about her envisioning a field and purchasing it and the vineyards and everything. What's this boat and food from afar? The boat is myself. It says she arises while it's yet nighttime, and then she gives some of their food to the maidens. What is this food that comes from a faraway place? It's not physical food, it's spiritual food. Because man does not live by bread alone, but by every word, everything that proceeds from the mouth of God. We're the ship. We're the merchant ships. And we have to leave our comfort zone, leave our busyness. We've got to get into the boat and put some distance between us and whatever we're doing and go to the far country, spend some time with him. Constantly. If you want to eat every day, you get in your boat and you go to him every day and you get the food and eat on it. And you bring some back to share with others. Okay? Because that's what the next verse says. And she gives some to her handmaids, those who are relying on her. You get it? We have to learn to read the Bible. It's not a matter of just translation. It's a matter of translating through the power of the soul and the spirit to see what it's truly saying to us. All right? That's the challenge of the Song of Solomon. All right, ready to roll up your sleeves and dive in and try your hand at a chunk of this? We're going to come back to chapter 1 in a moment, but let's go to Song of Solomon chapter 4. Here the man is describing this knockout, gorgeous woman who has stolen his heart. And how does he describe her? Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up from their washings. You just brushed them. All of which bear twins. In other words, none are missing. For every tooth on the left, there's a matching one on the right. And not one among them has lost her young. So you have all your teeth. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks, your cheekbones is really the word, are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. He's working his way down. Did you notice that? He's working his way down now to the more interesting parts. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. So you want to see a picture of this girl? There she is, right there. Okay? Mamma mia, right? So you see the goats are for her hair, and over here you see the pomegranate slices, and there's the doves looking back at you, and the thread lips, and there's the ewes, and there's her Tower of David neck, and then there's the two fawns. Now, I mean... yes. Can you imagine bringing her home to meet mom and dad, you know? See, but that's if you're not translating the allegory. That you're still just looking at in the physical. What we have to do is go back and look at this again and ask ourselves, now, how do these things make me feel? Not just how do they look, but what is it they elicit down deep inside of me? For example, the eyes like doves. First of all, they're white. They're clear. But doves just don't blink. I mean, you look at a dove, its eyeballs are looking right back at you. So there are two doves here. She's looking straight back into your eyes. There's nothing shy about this gal. On the neck, like a Tower of David, she's holding her head up. She's looking you straight in the eyeballs, buddy. This would be interpreted as brazen with anyone else, but this is his lover. She knows what's up. She's looking him square into the eye with her neck held high. It's like, come and get me. Cheeks like pomegranate slices. Okay, just think of the pomegranate slice. If you see a pomegranate slice, I start to salivate. I just want to grab it, and it's so sweet, it's so good. So cheeks like pomegranate slices means they are so kissable, I would put my mouth right on them. Lips like a scarlet thread. What's thread used for? To sew things together. I want my lips sewn right to yours. I want them connected to your lips. You get it? In fact, if you look at the very opening of the book, chapter 1, verse 2, she's talking and says that he kisses me with the kisses of his mouth, and that his kisses are better than wine. Okay? Now, they talk kisses, but you have to understand there's a whole lot more going on physically than just mouth to mouth. How about Let's go on down to the breast. You know, I see deer more now than I ever have in my life. We have foxes running around our house now. We hear them barking at night. Sounds like somebody getting strangled, but they terrible sound. But we, there's beautiful foxes. We see them once in a while. And we have Canadian geese. We've got all kinds of wildlife. And we see deer. Once in a while, you'll see a fawn. Now, when you see a fawn in your backyard, how do you feel? You want to go, aw. You want to just cuddle it and touch it. He says, your breasts are like two fawns. You get the picture? It's not a matter of looks. It's a matter of what response is elicited by these things. What is it deep in the soul? What does it mean? But we didn't even look at the last passage here. At the cool of the day, when the shadows flee away, okay, the sun's gone down, lights are out, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh. What did I say? Whenever there's a fragrance mentioned, what does it refer to? You remember, you don't have to say it out loud. This is being taped after all. Okay? What does it refer to? The mountain of myrrh? To the hill of frankincense? He's been working his way down. This is what comes last. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There's no blemish in you. And he would know if there was. Because there's nothing hidden. Now remember, as seductive and as lush and as sensual as this is, it's not just the physical sensuality between a man and a woman that's being discussed. It takes that level of physical sensuality to begin to capture the least little fraction of the kind of joy and intimacy, the life-generating power that there is when God and humans connect, when God and you connect and come together. And of the day when the bride of Messiah comes to the wedding feast of the Lamb. If you're married and you've experienced how wonderful marriage is, always remember this is just the tiniest little Costco sample of the feast that's waiting. And it's not physical, it's something spiritual and deep and eternal and life-changing. Something that never ends. But he gave us this powerful thing that is found in marriage to give us the glimmer of what's around the corner for eternity. That's the kind of God we have. You know, when I read Song of Solomon, and then I see pictures or go in or visit a church, or when you go to Israel, you'll see some of the churches and basilicas there with all the icons and the paintings and this and that. That to me looks so cold and sterile and lifeless and flat. And I think my God's a whole lot wilder than what they're painting up here. My God knows how to laugh out loud. And he knows how to sweep us off our feet. Like C.S. Lewis says, God, you know, Aslan is not a tame lion. Our God is not a tame God either. A God who could inspire this book of Song of Songs, that gives you a look into the heart of who God truly is. He's a righteous God. He's a good God. He's a jealous God. He doesn't want anybody messing with his people. And he doesn't want you being seduced away from him either. He takes that very seriously because his love for you is riotous and wild and lush and full and complete and total. And however strongly you've been sexually attracted to your husband or husbands to your wife, that's nothing compared to God's attraction to you. You are altogether beautiful. I find no blemish in you. And he can hardly wait You can hardly wait for that wedding day. Dennis Prager, in his book, it always seems like when I pick up his book and get a chance to read it, it has to do exactly what I'm talking about that week. He's talking in Exodus chapter 20 and 21. And he talks about how the restrictions God puts on keeping sex within marriage. And he's talking about when you build an altar, you don't make it so tall that your nakedness is seen on the altar. Because you see in all pagan religions at that time, and in most pagan religions today, sex and pagan worship are one and the same and mixed up in public. All of the Greek temples, the temples to Diana and these other Greek temples, all had temple prostitutes that worked there. And your worship was involved with this gross immorality. It's hard for us to imagine in this day and age, but that's the way it was. That's the way it's always been for thousands of years. And then God comes along with the Torah. And as Prager puts it, the complete desexualization of religion and of the family are two of the greatest achievements of the Torah. God says, no, 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 no. This is never put on display for public view. And you never combine it with a time of worship and of service to me. This is something for husband and wife in the bedroom. Because there it's a picture of the intimacy of the Holy of Holies. It's a picture of the spiritual intimacy I want to enjoy individually and with my bride together in the day to come. But you don't put it on display out there. You don't cheapen it with that. You keep it holy. You keep it private. You keep it special. Because it is truly a holy thing. So, let's go ahead and go to chapter 1. And let's just start walking through. My main thing today is to equip you to read this and to whet your appetite to read it with your spouse. If you're not married, I don't want you reading this your boyfriend or girlfriend. And unless you plan to elope immediately after, that's fine. But you read it with your spouse. And hopefully you'll be able to begin to interpret and pull out of the allegory what is being spoken of. So, here we go. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love, loves, it's plural, is better than wine. In other words, this is something that is just done over and over and over again. Now, the word for kiss is also the word for drink. It just is. And so this is why she compares his kisses like with drinking wine. She says, but it's better than wine. Now, as good as wine is delicious. It's healthy for you. It is used to celebrate, but there's a danger with wine. There's a certain line you don't cross, because the moment you become inebriated, you've now entered into sin. You've crossed the line of a healthy use into something that's a sinful use. Do not be drunk with wine or any other alcoholic beverage. Drunkenness should never be a part of our character as believers. But kissing, that's a whole different thing. No limit to that. It's better than wine. She's saying we can kiss all we want, and it's never too much. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. This is a hint to Mashiach, Messiah. Mashiach means anointed one. And right here in the second verse, we're being told who the bridegroom is. He's the one, you can smell the oil. He's been anointed. He's the Mashiach. Now, David was a Mashiach. He was an anointed one. He's called a Mashiach. Solomon is called a Mashiach. But then there's the one who's called HaMashiach, the Messiah, of which David and Solomon are merely pictures. You understand? So, we're told here who the bridegroom is. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. Now, according to commentators, that's the chorus singing. It's not the brides, the whole chorus, all the girls. Bring us into his chambers. Now, it's not talking about a courtroom when it talks about chambers. That's the bedroom. We will rejoice in you and be glad. This is the chorus continuing to sing. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. Now it goes back to the bride. Now we learn a lot about the girl here. She says, I am dark but lovely. I'm shechor is the word that's used. It means black, dark. And we find out she's dark because she's been out in the sun. She's really got a dark tan to her, which back at that time was not considered to be beautiful at all. The darker the skin was considered less beautiful among the Middle Eastern people, because people who worked outside got dark, but the finer uppity-ups could stay indoors during the day and not suffer the ravages of the sun. She says, I'm dark, but I'm lovely, I'm beautiful. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar. Now, the tents of Kedar, these tents were made out of a black goat hair. Okay, so she's very, very dark. Like the curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am swarthy or darkish. For the sun has burned me. Why is she spending all the time in the sun? Well, she tells us, my mother's sons were angry with me. Her mother's sons, that would be her brothers. My brothers were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards because I have not taken care of my own vineyard. Let's translate the allegory. What she's saying is, my brothers are ashamed of me. And they make me work out in the vineyards where they can keep an eye on me. Because I lost my virginity, I did not take care of my own vineyard. Now let's look at it on the spiritual level. If you're a Jewish person and you've given yourself to Yeshua HaMashiach, the Messiah, how are your brothers going to treat you for giving yourself away to this one? You see? You're cast out. You're pushed out. See what's being prophesied here? So she's a picture of the bride. She's a picture of the Jewish bride who's given herself to the Messiah. And they're treating her like one who has given herself away to someone she's not supposed to be with. But she doesn't care. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? Now the bridegroom speaks. He says, if you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock. Pasture your young goats by the shelters of the shepherds. In other words, follow my shepherds and you'll find me. Follow the rest of my flock and you'll finally find me as I'll be at the head of them. If you want to find me, follow my shepherds, follow my sheep. To me, my darling, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. Yeah, guys, try that on your girlfriend or on your wife. Yeah, you know, you're like a fine horse. I mean, really? But at that time, the horses of Egypt were considered to be the finest in the world. They were absolutely beautiful. And they would deck them. These horses, these mares would be decked in gold and jewels and precious stones. I mean, they were just... And there is no animal I know of other than the lion that has the dignity and the poise that a horse does. So you have to put yourself back in the culture of the day that this was actually a compliment. We will make for you ornaments of gold with beads of silver. That's what they did for the horses of the Pharaoh. So the chorus is saying, we'll make for you ornaments of gold with beads of silver. And then the bride says in verse 12, while the king was at his, you say table? It's not a table. If yours says a couch, that's getting close. If it says a bed, then you hit the bullseye. While the king was at his, we'll say, couch, my perfume, this is spikenard, gave forth its pregnancy. It's fragrance. When she saw him ready for her, her body begins to give off a fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. So you see the combination of fragrances is a picture of this unity, this oneness between them. They're lying together all night. And she describes it as the vineyards of En-Gedi. Those of you going to Israel or have been there, you go in the south into the Negev, and the only color you see is brown with blue sky. Blue above, everything's brown down here. It's desert, it's wilderness, it's dry, it's hot. You might see the Dead Sea over there a little bit, see a little bit of blue there. And it's just rock and dust and sand and gravel. It's a desolate, desolate place. And then you come to En-Gedi, where there's a water spring at the top that goes down into a pool, which tumbles over to another waterfall, into another pool, and another waterfall, into another pool, and another, and another, and another. And everything around is green and lush and beautiful, and the water is cool, and you can wade in it, you can sit in it, you can drink it, you can play in it, and there are animals coming down to drink. It's just life. It's just this lush, it's just exploding with life. And she's describing this connecting with her man as being like En-Gedi, this place in En-Gedi in the desert, where everything's alive. And verse 15, the bridegroom speaks, "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves." And then she says, "How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our bed is luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedars, our rafters, cypresses." So again, it's like the bedroom becomes En-Gedi, becomes this forest greenery. You never can quite tell where you're at. Chapter 2, "I am the rose of Sharon," the bride says, "the lily of the valleys." Then the groom says, "Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens." Then she says, "Like a quince tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade..." Now how does a man shade a woman? "In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He has brought me to his..." You ready for this? Yours says banqueting hall. His banner over me is love. Not a banqueting hall. It's a house of wine. House of wine is what it says. "He's brought me to his house of wine." Well, what's the wine they're drinking? The love, the physical love between the two. "His banner over me is ahava, his love. Sustain me with raisin cakes. Refresh me with quinces, because I am weak with love." She's so enthralled with him, her knees are weak. Verse 6, "Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me." I did not make a graphic for that, by the way. His left hand is under my head. Let his right hand embrace me. Get the picture? What's left? Physical. What's right? Spiritual. There's a place of intimacy that is hinted at in this phrase, but it's not explicit. And then the bride continues, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until it pleases." It's, what it basically means is, don't taunt me when my lover is absent. See, so time has passed. He's there, and now he's not there anymore. And she's now talking to all the other maidens who are making fun of her. Don't taunt me. And then the bride says, listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming. See, she was with him, and then a split second later, he's gone. No, that's my experience of God. Is it yours? Where a moment he's not there, and then you begin to pray, to focus on him, and meditate on something of the Word, and all of a sudden it's like he's there. You can just tell he's there. Now, he's always with us, but the awareness of his presence is, poof, it's like a light going on. And then the phone rings, and poof, it's gone. Or, time to eat, somebody says, poof, it's gone. Doorbell rings. Anything. Your computer dings, there's an email. And it's like that in this. There's this great intimacy, and it's gone. And then she looks for him again. Then suddenly he's there, and it's so sweet and good, and poof, he's gone again. It's this Alice in Wonderland kind of a setting where things are instantaneous. Time flows in weird ways. So now she's saying, listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. My beloved responded and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. Based on this, these two verses here, 11 and 12, rise to the tradition that Song of Solomon is read on the Shabbat of the week of Passover. Because Passover celebrates the spring. The winter is over. The spring has come. The latter rains have ended. The winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning. Now, what's interesting, that word pruning is the word zamir, which also means song or singing. I love that. We can just do a little rabbi trail here. None of us like pruning. Pruning is necessary for fruitfulness, right? Caleb came and pruned this tree that had gotten completely out of hand. Last year, he pruned it down to where it just looked like stubble. This year, it's twice as bushy as it was the year before. Because when you prune something, you take away, but for the purpose of greater abundance. That's what you do. You want more fruit. It's not very intuitive. You have to cut back limbs, and they produce more limbs and more fruit. But that word for pruning is also the word zamir, singing. Are you able to sing when God's pruning you? Are you able to sing when he's taking away? Because it's painful when he cuts away things and subtracts things from our lives. But can we sing because we know what the future brings? And we know what the purpose of his pruning is? Are we able to do that? And the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. In Judaism, the voice of the turtle dove, I think this is the only place that phrase appears in the Bible, is a reference to the Messiah's coming. I don't know quite how they get that, but it is. The fig tree has ripened its figs. The vines and blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. And then the bridegroom says in verse 14, O my dove, in the clefts of the rock and the secret place of the steep pathway, let me see your form. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your form is lovely. By that phrase, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, I put the word prayer. That's how God views your prayers. He loves you so much, he can't wait to hear from you. He says to each of you, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet. That's a kind of abundant love he's got for us. But there are always things interfering with our relationship with our beloved. So in verse 15, the chorus sings, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards, but our vineyards are in blossom. There's just this little warning stuck in there. There's always these foxes that are enemy of the fruitfulness and of the oneness and the joy and the pleasure. And our lives are filled with little foxes. They're called cell phones. They're called Facebook. They're called fill in the blank. Anything that's robbing away bits of time that could be invested in something really wonderful and really meaningful for eternity. What are the things that are eating away and chipping away, nibbling away at the intimacy between you and your beloved? What are the things eating away and nibbling away at the intimacy between you and your spouse? But then the bride continues in verse 16, "My beloved is mine, and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies." When you see lilies here, lilies are white. And the lilies are, again, a reference to the white part of her body. The part that doesn't see the sun. She does not have an even tan, is what I'm trying to say. And he's pasturing his flock among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the cloven mountains. Cloven mountains. Do you see the references? Now again, you've got to look at this on three levels. You see this flora and fauna, mountains and sheep, you know, grazing among lilies. Oh, what a painting, pretty painting. But that's a picture of something much more intimate, belongs only in the Holy of Holies of the bedroom. But that is just a spark, a sampling of something spiritual and utterly unsexual, but something deeper, something of which sex is just the merest sample, the merest picture of a deep and abiding, satisfying connection with God for all of eternity. We're the bride, he's the bridegroom. Get a little bit of the picture? Okay. What we're going to do is you are going to read Song of Solomon at least twice this week. If you're married, I want you to read it with your spouse. All right? Read a chapter or two a day. Go through it and discuss it. And we may only spend one more week on this book. Because this is the kind of book I think is meant to be studied and read, but not necessarily taught. If you know what I mean. It's a book for you to experience. It's a book for you to share with your spouse. It's a book to be prayed through. It's a book to open up your hearts and minds, how much God, how riotous his love is for you, and how he is not ashamed of you, but to you, him, you are altogether lovely, altogether beautiful. I find no blemish in you. And so you can open your eyes and stare at him like dove's eyes. You can hold your head high. Because if he says you're gorgeous, you're gorgeous. If he says you're good enough, you're good enough. If he says I don't see any blemishes, then who are you to point them out to him? Yeah, there are things to work on in our lives. But love covers a multitude of those shortcomings. And he loves you like you have no idea. And he wants to be with you a whole lot more than you want to be with him. Your creator, your perfect God, your Savior. He wants you so much that hurts. All right? So, do you like Song of Solomon so far? I mean, how can you not, right? How can you not? So, a few minutes. Yes, some comments or questions. Not that I'll answer them, but you're welcome to ask them. So, here's a microphone right here for Deborah. Yep. I still can't hear you.
Great.
Great Expectations. Yeah, Charles Dickens, great book. Okay, yes, Walt, right here. Okay, just a second. We're still having issues with the microphone. And The guy in the sound booth just threw his hands up in the air.
Trainer.
Hey, that worked. Thanks, DJ. Keep doing it. Keep your hands. It's like Moses with the staff. Keep them up there, buddy. All right. I think the first one worked.
Bethany.
There we go. All right.
Wake up.
Okay.
With David and all the things he struggled with, the women,
yeah.
His sin, and he come down and he said, "Return to me the joy of my salvation."
Yes.
Then I can share you with us.
Yeah.
And I just, all your whole teaching smart, my mind just kind of stuck there in Psalm 51.
Psalm 51. Well, let's read that along with Song of Solomon. That's a good suggestion. Well, yeah. We need the joy of our salvation restored every once in a while. We get used to being saved. We should never get used to that. You know, this would be something fresh every day. Yeah, thank you. Someone else? We have a couple minutes left. Everyone's way too shy. Okay, Dale.
Okay, Dale. Personal testimony. I had a lot of pornography in my youth, which I had to overcome when I got married. There was no greater desire in my heart but to love my wife and love my wife only. But I had all these images in my mind.
Yeah.
I had all this baggage. I had all this fighting. And the best thing that happened to me, and it took a year minimum, I'd say. And I finally got to love my wife for who she was, and not having someone else in front of me. It's just a warning.
Yes, yes. Amen. Yeah, we live in dangerous times. The enemy hates wholesome relationship between a man and a woman. He hates it. Because every time he sees that, it's a picture of God's love for us and our love for him. And he wants to mar that. He wants to send those foxes in there to nibble away and destroy and distort, pollute. And that's why it's so difficult to talk about this without the worldly images in our culture kind of invading and pulling our minds in ways that they shouldn't go. What God wants to do is restore us to like Adam and Eve before they sinned. To where things are pure and good. There was no shame. There was no sin. It was just the way it should be. But boy, when sin invades, his pictures get so distorted. And it's a sad thing. It really is a sad thing. But he's going to restore the image that's been lost, isn't he? Yes, Jim. Let's get a microphone here, and then Charlotte. Yeah, here you go.
Is the banishment of the Jewish family to a member of the family that accepts Yeshua still similar to the description in Song of Solomon, or is there a by God's Spirit recognition of a blessing?
Well, there is still the rejection. I don't know, though they send the kid out to the vineyards to work. They may not own vineyards, but that whole send them out to the vineyards basically means just go away, go someplace else. We don't want you in the house. Just, we don't want you around. And it's a picture of that rejection. So, but it's not, again, they don't send kids out to the vineyard. They just treat them like they're dead altogether. Yeah. And Charlotte, you had your hand up. Oh, here's the microphone. There we go. Oh, you have to suffer the microphone if you're going to ask a question.
Psalm 45 is a picture of this song.
Psalm 45 is a picture of the Song of Solomon? Okay, thank you. Charlotte is really a student of the Psalms. Yeah, Psalm 45 is a song for Messiah's wedding. And thank you for bringing that up. Psalm 45, amazing, amazing song. Yep. Thank you. Is this a good time to close? All right. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for this amazing song. The best song in the entire world. In human history, this is the song of songs. Lord, I pray you teach us how to embrace it, how to study it, and how to see you in it. And Father, help us to correct any coldness that's crept into our relationship with you, and then has crept into our marriages as well. Father, may we realize again that your love for us is with abandon. And everything we see in nature that we say is so beautiful, whether it's a tree or grass or insects or animals or birds, flowers, whatever it is, it's all a product of a union. And you've made your world lavish with pictures of life that always comes from union of two opposites. It's as if there's nothing that's on your heart more that you want to drive home to humanity than you love us. Will we just love you back? Thank you for the life that comes out of this. And thank you for the joy. Thank you for the strength and the purity that there is for us in our union with you. And help us to be the people you want us to be. For you certainly are even more than any kind of God we could have ever imagined or wanted. You're so much better. Help us to know you better so we can love you better. And we give you praise for all of this in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen.